Guardian Unlimited.
I'm Alok Jha, and this is Science Weekly for February the 4th. Coming up on this week's podcast, pick a number, any number. Just make sure it's a good one. Marcus de Sotoy joins us to discuss dynamic digits, mathematical mysteries, and cracking complex codes. Also in the show, as Microsoft launch a bid for Yahoo, we'll be asking what such a merger would mean for Google and the rest of the web world. Plus, nuclear physicist Jim Al-Khalili tells us about the golden age of Arabic science and its influence on later generations. All this and yet another rant against homeopathy. If it ain't a mess, it'll do until the mess gets here. This is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. The pod is fit to burst this week, and with all apologies to Allen Ginsberg, crammed with some of the best minds of our generation. Destroyed by madness, it's James Randerson, The Guardian's science correspondent.
It hurts.
Starving and hysterical, it's Guardian's technology correspondent, Bobby 2.000 Johnson.
I think you should have howled that. Oh!
I don't even know how to do it. Looking for an angry fix, it's Nell Bowes from The Guardian's arts team.
Well, it is a Friday. Oh, it's not. It's a Monday.
Don't spoil the illusion, woman. Finally, the angel-headed hipster, Ian Sample.
I'm bemused.
You are. You're always bemused. Pod Squad, good to have you all on board, but pause for a moment as I introduce our main guest. Yes, our special guest this week is Marcus de Sotoy, Professor of Maths at the University of Oxford and one of the country's most engaging scientists. In 2001, he won the prestigious Berwick Prize, awarded every 2 years to the best research by a mathematician under the age of 40. That was for completely transforming Grünewald, Segal and Smith's study of zeta functions associated to infinite groups. Zeta functions is also one of the subjects of his new book, Finding Moonshine. Marcus, welcome to the pod. I have no idea what a zeta function is. Can you help us out? Tell us what that meant.
Well, I've just written a book all about infinite groups, which is hoping to sort of download a little bit about what my magical world is all about.
Well, your book is, for the less mathematically able of us, about symmetry. You call this one of the most significant concepts in maths, but is it more than just mirror images and that kind of thing, I'm assuming?
I think most people's first impressions are that symmetry is about reflectional symmetry, you know, the symmetry on your face, left-right symmetry, and maybe they know about rotational symmetry as well. This new book I've written sort of illustrates how complex this idea of symmetry is. And actually, you know, to say whether two objects have the same symmetries or not is actually a very deep question. And it really took until the 19th century for mathematicians to develop a language to really articulate what symmetry is. We've sort of seen it all around us in dice, in the wonderful images in the Alhambra, for example, in music as well. Musicians have been exploring the ideas of symmetry to produce themes and variations. But it was actually a very romantic figure called Galois in the 19th century, who died at the age of 20 in a duel over love and politics. And already by the age of 20, he devised this language, which is called group theory. So that infinite groups that I was won my prize for is about this language to understand symmetry.
So given that symmetry is everywhere and you know, everyone knows what symmetry is, why did it take so long? What was so difficult about this problem?
I think it comes down to, I have a chapter in the book where I go to the Alhambra and I take my son there, who was 9 at the time, and I sort of ask him, I showed him two walls in the Alhambra and said, okay, do you think these have the same symmetries or not? Now, the pictures look utterly different, and your first impression, these have nothing to do with each other. But actually articulating why the underlying symmetry of these things is the same took that until the 19th century. And what we understood was, it's not the actual pictures you need to look at, it's actually the sort of transformations that you can do to the pictures. It's the actions that you can do, which are the same in both pictures, although the pictures are very different. And it's a very abstract leap to take yourself out of the very physical and think of an abstract language. And this group theory really takes you from pictures into something much more linguistic. And once you've got those linguistic tools, then actually you start to see symmetry all over the place where, you know, you don't really think there's any symmetry there at all.
So give us an example of that, somewhere that's a bit surprising for symmetry to crop up.
For example, in quantum physics, actually. I mean, there's a lot of symmetry in physics, which, it looks like nothing physical, but actually the fundamental particles, we've actually, at first sight, they look like a complete menagerie of wild and difficult to understand things. But when you actually see that actually they're examples of symmetries of a particular object in eight-dimensional space, and then you start to see that the whole thing makes total sense because they're sort of different facets of a object which lives in eight-dimensional space, which has a lot of symmetry to it.
Nothing in eight-dimensional space makes any sense to me, I have to say, even in maths.
well, again, that's about language. And if you go back to Descartes, for example, Descartes showed how to make pictures into coordinates. If you have a two-dimensional picture, you can translate that into two numbers. Well, the lovely thing about mathematics is sometimes one side of this sort of dictionary carries on whilst the other one runs out. Pictures run out after three dimensions. But these numbers, you can take four numbers describing something in four-dimensional space or five numbers in five-dimensional space. So the numbers carry on and take you into these wonderful worlds of the mind where the pictures run out. So, although we can see shadows of these things. If you go to the arch at La Défense in Paris, that's actually a shadow of a four-dimensional cube in three dimensions, although I'm not sure many of the Parisians know
while,
that.
While I think about that very, very hard concept, James, you've got a question.
Yeah, there's actually a couple of things from the book I wanted to pick up with you. You mentioned just now these wonderful worlds of the mind, and you say in the book that several mathematicians have used cannabis to help them to get their heads around some concepts. Is it? I mean, names would be good, but failing that, what sort of concepts are we talking about?
There's a lot of imagination needed to do mathematics, and a lot of leaps of faith sometimes, and looking at things in new ways. And so I know several mathematicians, one who's won the Fields Medal, so that will limit it down. I will not name him. But in the last decade, there is a mathematician who, not cannabis, but speed. And he requires speed to be able to do. And I tell you, his mathematics is totally spacey. I mean, you understand that this must have come from somewhere really extraordinary. And so I do think it can help you to make leaps into the unknown. Then I think, it's those sane moments where you've got to put all the logical bits in place.
The other half of my question is, you mentioned that that you have a favourite colour for doing maths on, which is these yellow legal pads. And I noticed you've got some very stylish yellow trousers on as well. What is it about yellow?
I really don't know what it is, but it goes back right to my childhood when I first went down into the bookshop in Blackwell's in Oxford, where all the maths books are, and all the maths books are yellow. I mean, it's extraordinary. I don't know quite what it is about. Maybe it's The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, where he's obsessed with mathematics and he's also obsessed with colours. You know, if he sees cars of a different colour, it upsets his day. So maybe it's some... I mean, it's a very happy colour, I think, yellow. It's a very vibrant colour, and it's sort of... I just love doing my maths on yellow legal papers.
Yellow is my favourite colour. Apparently, I'm a Leo, so it's my lucky colour as well, because my planet's the sun. Bobby, you've got a question.
Yeah, well, first of all, I was thinking also the Four Dummies books are also yellow, so there's some...
Oh, yeah.
Thing. And is banana the best thing to eat while you're doing maths as well? Forgotten the question I was going to ask.
This could go on.
I was interested, when you're thinking in abstractions the whole time, does that mean when you walk around, you see the world in a different way?
Like the Matrix.
Yeah, is it like you're Keanu Reeves or something?
It does really affect the way you see the world. And so, and I witnessed that when I was going around the Alhambra. I could not take my eyes off these images whilst the rest of the tourists were just kind of flooding through, just didn't realise what they were seeing. And so if somebody comes in with a tie, for example, I will immediately look at the pattern on their tie and try and match it up to one of the classifications of the symmetries that you see in the Alhambra. And I'll say, oh my gosh, you've got a lovely 422 on the front of your tie. And so it does. And of course, my family hate this because it takes me sometimes to get out of this world and to start talking normally sometimes. So,
You're doing well now. Ian, you've got a question.
Yeah, forgive it. It's quite a geeky question, but then we are in a sort of a fairly geeky podcast. But I was just going to ask about whether you think symmetry and this interesting idea of the symmetry breaking is going to turn out to have played much of a role in the sort of separation of the forces at the beginning of the universe, when you sort of have the Big Bang and the sort of separation out from one superforce into the four we see now.
I think already you can see that the great successes we've had in physics have come down to understanding symmetries underlying these things. Already, with Maxwell, with electromagnetism, That is an observation that electricity and magnetism are basically symmetrical, and they are two sides of the same equation. And we already understand we've been able to unify three of the forces, and that comes down to a beautiful symmetrical object, which is one of the things I talk about in the book, the classification of this. And I think, you know, the recent work of Garrett Lissy, which has caused a lot of interest, whether he actually has made the breakthrough to unify those forces with gravity, his aim is to try and find some large symmetrical object in which you can embed relativity and quantum physics. And that, I think, shows how fundamental symmetry is, that it seems to lie there right down at the foundations of the way the universe is put together.
Marcus, so one of the most famous things that people know about mathematicians seems to be that most mathematicians make their best discoveries before they're 40. The Fields Medal, the Nobel of Maths, is awarded to people who are under 40. Now, your book starts with the fact that it's your 40th birthday in the Sinai Desert, and it's 40 degrees, and 40 plays a big role in the beginning of the book. Have you done all your best work? Surely not.
No, the book is sort of aims to prove this myth wrong. And I think it is a very significant myth, and people get rather traumatized by it, which is why I thought it was a significant moment to start the book on that 40th birthday. Intriguingly, the Fields Medal, when Fields gave the medal and he said, "I want it to be given under 40, his aim was to encourage people to carry on doing more mathematics, that unlike the Nobel Prizes, which tend to be awarded at the end of a career, and, well, what's the point in that? It's not very, what's the use of a medal at the end? Fields was hoping that it would be a platform for doing more mathematics. Well, unfortunately, it's sort of gone against us, and now it looks like it's saying, well, if you've reached 40, you've finished it, so you're not going to do anything new.
You're not giving up.
No, there are a lot of examples in the book of people who've only started studying symmetry at the age of 50 and made great breakthroughs, so I'm I have to be optimistic.
Well, Marcus, thank you. You're going to be helping us out with some of the other topics today, and we'll be finding out more about some of history's most famous maths mysteries later on in the show. Marcus's new book is Finding Moonshine, The Search for Symmetry. I'm Alok Jha. You're listening to Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Still to come, theoretical nuclear physicist Jim Al-Khalili gives us his take on the golden age of Arabic science in this week's Thought for the Pod. Plus, we'll hear your feedback on the subject of coral reef destruction in the Caribbean. Hang around for all of that, because right now it's time to catch up on the other science and tech news that's been making headlines over the past 7 days. Here's Nell and Bobby with the News Jam.
News Jam.
Microsoft has launched an audacious $44 billion bid to buy Yahoo in a deal that would create an online advertising powerhouse to rival Google. There's been intense speculation about the two internet giants getting together. Microsoft's approached Yahoo several times over the past few years, but Bill Gates and company's covetous advances have always been rebuffed. If the deal goes ahead, it will rank as one of the largest dot-com takeovers since AOL and Time Warner merged at the height of the dot-com boom.
A campaign by leading scientists to remove alternative therapy from the NHS has resulted in more than a fifth of state-run hospital trusts cancelling or reducing funding of homeopathy in the past 2 years. In two open letters to primary healthcare trust managers last year, the scientists, including a Nobel Prize winner and six fellows of the Royal Society, criticised homeopathic remedies because they claim its results are unsupported by scientific evidence.
Warmer waters in the North Atlantic have made hurricanes stronger and more frequent in the past decade. That's according to a team at University College London's Hazard Research Centre. The study has raised fears that global warming could unleash more devastating storms in the region, especially if sea temperatures continue to increase.
And finally, a new species of mammal has been discovered in the mountains of Tanzania. The bizarre-looking creature is a type of giant elephant shrew, or sengi. It's the size of a cat and, according to the Journal of Zoology, looks like a cross between a miniature antelope and an anteater. It has spindly legs, a long, flexible snout, an amber body and a jet-black rump.
Nell and Bobby, thank you for all of those. Let's go into a couple of those stories. Bobby, the Yahoo Microsoft thing. Now, I do want to point out that we do have an entirely separate Tech Weekly podcast for the Ultra Geeks, but for the more accessible amongst us, Bobby, explain this whole thing to us.
Very popular it is too, Alok, by the way. This came as a bit of a surprise last week. We know that Yahoo and Microsoft have been talking together a lot about the potential to be involved with one another. But Microsoft has made this huge bid way over the stock price. to try and scare everyone else away and snap up Yahoo for itself, use it basically to make up for the fact that it's had a really crap online strategy for years.
Well, $44 billion. Surely even Microsoft doesn't have that much money just hanging
Microsoft
around.
Microsoft has an awful lot of money. It's a 50% stock and cash deal. They've got about $20 billion in the bank at the moment. They're all right. The interesting thing, I think, is I was just on a conference call earlier listening to their plans, what they said they're going to do. And there is an interesting aspect to it that I think might be quite useful for, you know, the science community. I was thinking about this, you see, bringing it back. And they said what they're going to do is potentially use Yahoo to kind of integrate all of the Office applications and, you know, all the stuff that you have running on your computer, integrate that over the web, which they've tried to do before but failed. And I think that's got really interesting possibilities for collaboration online between people in very disparate areas. So, you know, I think if this doesn't sound like a story you're interested in, it should be. And if you're really interested in it, you can go and listen to...
I was going
to
ask you. Go on.
Well, if you're really interested in it, you can go and listen to our Tech Weekly special that we put out, Tech Extra, which you can find on the Guardian website, guardian.co.uk/technology.
Is this actually a done deal here?
No.
Or is it...
No, it's not. But if you're the board of a company and somebody offers you 60% over your share price to buy you, it's going to be impossible to turn it down. You know, they can make an argument and say, we think we can survive this bad period. But at the same time, we've been performing really crappily for the past few years. There's no kind of nothing good on the horizon. Somebody comes up with a bunch of cash, you know, I don't think they can say no.
Has there been any response from Google?
I spoke to Google earlier, actually, and they...
What did they say? Holy shit!
I tried my hardest. They said this is a deal for two other companies to sort out between them. It wouldn't give Microsoft, Yahoo, a larger share of the market than Google in terms of internet search and the things they're really after. It would make them more competitive. Unfortunately for Microsoft, of course, we all know that what comes up whenever they do anything is... anti-competition law, and the idea that Google is the big player here and these other two could come together and create another force. Well, if you're worried about Google being a monopoly, aren't you just turning it into a complete duopoly instead of having more players? So I think they might have problems getting it through the Department of Justice and the European Commission.
Well, more on that on the Tech Weekly podcast and the Tech Extra, of course. Ian, the hurricane story, tell us a bit more about that.
Well, so we've known that the warmer the surface waters of seas are, the more you will more powerful hurricanes you'll get. I mean, that's just it's just the physics. You'll have, you know, more energy and water vapor that goes up into storms, and that drives the hurricanes. What this research out of UCL did last week was it actually quantifies the effect. It actually says, okay, for in this case, a half degree sea rise, that means you'll see a 40% increase in hurricane activity. And by hurricane activity, they mean a kind of mix of intensity of those hurricanes, how powerful they are, and also the frequency of the hurricanes, how many you get per season. And so they're just saying, okay, warmer waters are and have done over the past 10 years or so driven more hurricane activity in the north, in the Atlantic.
And have they linked it to climate change? I mean, of course, it is somehow linked, isn't it?
Well, this study didn't look at it didn't look at anthropogenic, you know, a human contribution to the sea surface temperature warming, but rising temperatures are obviously part of climate change picture. And last year there were some guys at Lawrence Livermore lab who did a load of modeling, and they pulled out you can use the models to look at all the factors that cause sea surface temperatures to warm up. They did that, and then they took out what the warming should be because of greenhouse gas emissions, and the warming was nothing like what we've seen. So they said, look, we can show that the seas are getting warmer because of human activity, or they're pretty damn confident. So if you look through all the other research, then the picture's there.
Okay, James, why don't you rant a bit about homeopathy again?
Well, you know, the ranting is very ably done by this group of science silverbacks who've written these two letters over the course of a couple of years trying to persuade the NHS not to waste its money on homeopathy. It's people like Michael Baum, David Colquhoun and Ed Zardens, and others. And they're essentially saying, you know, the NHS shouldn't be wasting money on treatments that are no better than placebo. You know, all the best studies show that to be the case. And they also object to the fact that by backing homeopathy, you're sort of undermining evidence-based science.
This is going to affect things like the Royal London Homeopathic Hospital, Prince Charles's favourite place.
He's a big fan, yeah.
Yeah, so tell us, what is it? Is it that referrals are going down? Is it the NHS trusts are saying...
Yeah, NHS trusts are referring fewer patients, and some NHS trusts have stopped referrals altogether. So 20% fewer NHS trusts are doing referrals now. So.
Marcus, can I ask you, what do you make of homeopathy? Is it something that you spend any time thinking about at all, or do you think, you know, it doesn't do any harm, it doesn't really cost that much? Let's just leave
it. The trouble
alone.
Is it does cost money, and it costs also some sort of emotional attachment to this as well. I mean, I have a constant battle in my family where my partner is very pro-homeopathy, and I'm trying to persuade her of the science. I think, James, you're absolutely right. It does undermine the sort of whole principle of science that, you know, you have to base your thing on evidence and experiment, and evidence experiment doesn't support this at all. It just shows it's a placebo. So I think it's a real battle here. It's not just about homeopathy. It's really about the whole process of science at heart here.
Nell, Bobby, what do you think?
I'm just wondering, as this kind of debate should be happening in sort of more formally rather than from letters written through a few silverback scientists.
Well, I guess they would say, you know, they've got frustrated with the fact that the NHS is spending money on this, and so they wanted to kind of publicly embarrass some NHS trusts. I mean, at the end of the day, the NHS trusts make decisions on this, and, you know, it's hard to say whether this 20% drop is really due to that campaign or whether NHS trusts are, you know, saying to themselves, we've got to cut some, you know, we've got to save money, we've got to balance our books, and this is an easy thing to lose. But, you know, one way or the other, that's what's happened.
I think it's just really interesting how we ended up in this at this point anyway. If you saw the government spending a substantial amount of money on anything else that was unprovable, people would be up in arms. They'd be saying, oh, that's my money, you're throwing it down the drain. Here we have a completely different situation where enough people are behind homeopathy that, you know, questions don't get asked at the right levels. And, you know, I think maybe we need more people in Parliament and elsewhere to champion this and take it. You know, if trusts are told not to spend this money, they can't spend it. So maybe it should happen at a higher level.
The problem might be that lots of MPs and Lords still think that homeopathy is a good thing. And
I'll stick a needle in their eye to
the debates.
Think otherwise.
If you ever watch the debates on this sort of thing in the Houses of Parliament, they're quite amazing. Right, we're going to wrap things up. But actually, before we do, Nell, the giant elephant shrew. It's not actually a shrew, as you said, but I want to, before I come to you, I want to know if anyone can pronounce this Latin name. Ian, give it a go.
Rhinococcion udzungvensis.
James, go on.
Rhinococcion?
Well, you can just copy me, can't you?
Ian got it right, as far as I'm concerned.
No,
he didn't get it right. And Nell's got the right answer.
Rhinococcion udzungvensis.
This is why we have her here. Bit of round of applause, please.
There's an O in there, though.
No, it's a typo. It's
guys.
Oh, wow.
Let's,
you rigged that.
Let's wrap that up there. Remember, if you want to have any your say on any of this stuff, you can discuss it at the science blog, blogs.guardian.co.uk/science. Last week, we introduced a brand new item to the pod that was in no way inspired by a long-running feature on BBC Radio 4. Our first thought for the pod was by the New Humanist editor Caspar Melville. He gave us his take on the Pope's statements about the astronomer Galileo. It created quite a storm on the blog. DS Go said it would be hilarious if this lot didn't command quite so much power. Anyone in any doubt as to the cynical imperialism that lies at the heart of the Catholic Church should visit the Vatican. Pope-branded currency converter, anyone? Meanwhile, ENG Blog said,
there can be no excuse for the maltreatment of Galileo by the ecclesiastical and academic authorities of his day. But modern secular science is not innocent in this respect. One thinks of the treatment meted out to Semmelweis, Wegener, etc. Mistreatment of scientists holding unfashionable theories continues apace. A case of the pot calling the kettle black, don't you think?
And on the perennial issue of creationism, Michael Francis Chatfield from Trinidad and Tobago wrote on our Facebook wall,
sorry, is this the guy who was Welsh in that other...
He might have been, yes.
We should get Tim Maybe to do it again. As a religious person, the wrong kind of religious fundamentalism is exerting an increasingly important hold on too many people. The debate may be frustrating and or tedious to those of us on the evolution side, but we need to keep our voice loud. It's a well-worn quote, the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. And if we don't speak out, then many more people may be hypnotised by the creationists' claims.
Hear, hear. OK, well, let's move on to this week's subject. The ancient Greek and Renaissance periods are, of course, lauded in the history of science, but what about the influence of the Arabic world? Here's theoretical nuclear physicist and friend of the pod, Jim Al-Khalili, with his thought for the pod.
We often forget in the West that there have been, throughout the history of human civilization, not two, but three major periods of rapid scientific progress and incredible achievements. For in between the ancient Greeks 2,000 years ago and the European Renaissance that began about 500 years ago was the golden age of Arabic science. The period between the 8th and the 11th centuries AD, and to a lesser extent for a further 200 or 300 years after, saw a flourishing of mathematics, astronomy, philosophy, medicine, as well as many other fields that was in fact crucial to the European Renaissance movement. Note that I've carefully used the term Arabic science here rather than Islamic science. By Arabic, I mean that which was carried out by those who used the Arabic language in their scientific writing, even though many of the greatest of them weren't Arabs but Persians. But many of the early scholars were not Muslims either. Instead, what unified Muslims, Christians and Jews, Arabs and Persians, was the Arabic language. It would remain the international language of science for 700 years. The point is that there's no such thing as Islamic science or Muslim science, as it's often portrayed both in the West and in the Muslim world today. Science cannot be characterised by the religion of those who engage in it. Of course, we are rightly critical of Nazi Germany, for instance, in the 1930s, for referring to Einstein's theory of relativity as Jewish science, although in that case it was purely to undermine the quality of the work. No one would argue with the breadth and importance of the science carried out during the golden age of Arabic science. But to call it Islamic science could be dangerous. There's just science, albeit carried out at the time mainly by Muslims. Of course, that this golden age of science would not have taken place without Islam is a different matter, and not in any doubt. What is important in today's world of often heightened religious and cultural tensions is that the West acknowledge its debt to the scholars of early Islam, and that Muslims around the world feel a pride in their heritage, because this was a time of rational religious tolerance that placed the Islamic world at the very centre of civilization.
That was Jim Al-Khalili, and we put the full text of that monologue on the blog. Marcus, Jim mentioned right at the beginning there the contribution of Arabic scientists to maths. What kind of influence have they had?
They have been influential, and I've just been making a series for the BBC about the history of mathematics, and one of the programmes I particularly enjoyed is the second one, where we sort of uncovered this gap that people think from the Greeks to the Renaissance there was no mathematics going on, but there was a huge amount in China, in the Arabic world, and I think most importantly, actually, in India. And one of the greatest contributions of the Arabs was actually to bring the Indian mathematics to Europe. They actually learnt about the numeral system. We call it the Arabic numeral system, but actually should be called the Hindu numeral system. They were the ones who invented zero, who created the numbers from 1 to 9 that we use. But the great contribution of the Arabs in mathematics was really to create this language of algebra. And it's this algebraic language which has become very powerful in understanding, for example, the world of symmetry that I talk about in the book.
So. Is it true also that a lot of things like Pythagoras' theorem were being discussed by these people many, many years before Pythagoras thought of his triangles?
Yes, I think poor old Pythagoras gets a rough deal these days because everyone's saying actually he probably didn't even exist even. But yeah, we found evidence of the Babylonians knew quite a lot about Pythagorean triangles, also the ancient Egyptians. But I still think it was the ancient Greeks who really moved mathematics on from just sort of examples of triangles with this to actual proofs that all right-angled triangles will satisfy this theorem of Pythagoras. So I still don't want to do the Greeks out of the great things they did for science.
Very good. Well, look out for more thoughts for the pod in the coming weeks.
Hi, folks. This is Brian May. You're listening to Science Weekly on Guardian Unlimited.
Thank you to everyone who got in touch after last week's programme. Affront said all sorts of nice things which made us feel all warm and gooey inside.
Yeah, another excellent podcast. Many thanks.
And then he went on to say,
Just as a matter of interest, I'm buying more copies of the paper since I started listening to The Guardian's podcast. Presumably, that's the general idea. I'd also be very happy to hear ads incorporated into programmes if it increases the likelihood that the free service will continue.
Which got me into trouble because I didn't follow the party line about the audio team's business model. Rest assured, I'm now utterly convinced that adverts, but not many of them, are the way to make sure that these podcasts remain free and that producer Ben gets to eat. Anyway, that's all by the by. The main talking point to come out of last week's show was our rather dismissive discussion about the destruction of coral reefs in the Caribbean.
I was surprised to hear coral reef bleaching referred to as mainly a problem for tourism. Corals are colony creatures. Surely the die-off of large areas of coral is significant for their survival and the survival of the numerous species that depend on that particular ecosystem.
That was from Sunwarm, and this post is from Ozymandias One, who accused us of having twisted logic.
As I understand your argument, climate change is warming up the sea. The sea is therefore holding more CO2, leading to the destruction of coral reefs. This ultimately impacts the tourist industry, which is important to the Caribbean economy. Elsewhere in the podcast, you argue that to reduce carbon emissions, we should reduce our use of air travel for the purposes of recreation. Therefore, the destruction of the reefs will have a positive effect of reducing travel and thereby balancing the carbon equation. I admit that this has an unfortunate impact on a poor area of the world, but your lack of logic undermines the arguments for our necessary actions to cure the problem.
Well, quite. Perhaps Slingman23 put it best by saying,
"We can't underestimate the importance of coral in itself. Yes, it's a human problem and it does affect us and our self-interest to lose coral, but this form of life isn't quite so resilient as it is painted in the podcast. If you go to areas of the world where coral used to be abundant but now only barely surviving through tight control, try going to a less developed country next door and you'll see mountains of dead coral piled high along the coast. As a species, our capacity for callous destruction is unique."
Nice voiceover work, team. Let's move on. We're going to do some more maths now. Marcus Asoto has been with us throughout the show. Marcus, a few years ago, you gave the Royal Institution's Christmas lectures called The Number Mysteries. So let's go through a couple of those. Fermat's Last Theorem, something that people might have heard of. Can you solve it for us in a few minutes?
Well, no longer a mystery, but I can't fit it into the margin of this podcast like Fermat couldn't in the margin of his book. But it goes back to one of the big problems of mathematics, which is solving equations. What numbers can you put into an equation which will make the equation work? So if you've got Pythagoras' theorem is about x squared plus y squared equals z squared. Well, you can find whole numbers 3 squared plus 4 squared is equal to 5 squared. Fermat said if you don't take squares but cubes, you'll never be able to find whole numbers which will make this equation work. Cubes or fourth powers or fifth powers. And this was the great unsolved problem for 350 years, which was finally proved by Andrew Wiles about 10 years ago.
Did you reckon he really had the proof, Matt? I mean, really?
I mean, I tell you what, I think that he had a method to be able to do it for cubes, and it's you can prove for cubes that there aren't any solutions using an idea called Fermat descent, which he developed. And that's why it's called Fermat descent. So I think he thought that would generalize to fourth powers and fifth powers, and that's what he was thinking about. So I think he had some part of the proof.
Because as far as I know, I thought Andrew Wiles had to use maths that was invented in the 1950s to
Oh, absolutely.
Come up with his proof.
I don't think Fermat did not have the tools to be able to prove the full version of Fermat's Last Theorem to apply to all equations. And the interesting thing is, of course, these equations aren't particularly interesting equations, but what they've acted as a fantastic catalyst for generating the most exciting mathematics of the 20th and 21st century.
So there's actually a prize, isn't there? A million dollar prize for various mathematical conundrums. Can you take us through a couple of those?
Yeah, there's $7 million in offer, and it might be that one of those million has already been claimed last year.
You, surely?
No, I wish it were me. This is open to anyone over 40 as well, but this one was, it will probably be claimed by Grigori Perlman, who The Guardian ran with a great story of him turning down the Fields Medal a year ago. He proved it before he was 40. The Poincaré conjecture is what he proved, which is about the shapes that our universe, what the possible shapes our universe could be. And he's understood what those shapes can be. So this sort of geometric problem. So that one probably has been solved. There's, of course, the great mystery of prime numbers, which is subject of my first book.
Yeah, that's right. I was going to say that you're a big fan of prime numbers.
I love prime numbers,
You call them the atoms of maths.
Yeah, they're like the hydrogen and oxygen of our world. world, and they build all other numbers, and that's why they're so fundamental, yet they still represent one of the greatest mysteries in our subject. So I was quite intrigued that Sling Man chose to be Sling Man 23. He's obviously also obsessed with
David
prime
Beckham,
numbers.
Maybe.
But David or Beckham, well. Beckham. Well, my football team, we all play in prime numbers, you see, from 2 to 43. I thought I'd take a leaf
excellent.
Out of David Beckham's book. We got promoted the season we changed our kit. So,
do you play in non-prime number leagues? one.
Yeah, we play in the Super Sunday League Division 1. One was a prime number
in
Gauss.
Do you play in a symmetrical formation?
We use non-hyperbolic. We use hyperbolic triangles, which is okay, what Arsenal
that
does. Cesc Fabregas has got obviously non-Euclidean geometry sussed out.
James,
in the book, you say that you always wanted to be a spy, and I was just wondering whether you actually are a spy. I think this would be a
well, he's not
going to
tell
cover.
You, is he?
It'd be a great cover. You know, you go around the world.
But I then have to kill every man in this podcast room.
I know all about the glamorous lives you academics lead, where you go off to conferences all the time, you know, in exotic places like Russia, where you can take some people out at the same time.
Yes, no, I've just been in Russia, I've been in Syria, I've been in Romania just recently. So, but of course, if you go to GCHQ, where they do all this code cracking, it's of course full of mathematicians, because mathematics is now the way the codes are made and broken. So
there you go, learn maths, become a spy.
Yeah, that's right.
Can you tell us a bit more about your upcoming TV series? You're doing the story of maths for the BBC.
Yes, we're trying to condense 7,000 years of mathematics into 4 hours. So we've got 4 one-hour programmes going from ancient Babylon through to the modern day. Try to go and find Grigory Perelman in the suburbs of St. Petersburg. But
did you find him?
We didn't find him. He's very recluse. I found out where his flat is, but he's disconnected the bell. All the bells around his neighbours worked, but his didn't. So, but I think what I'm going for is a kind of Michael Palin meets Bronowski kind of program. So it's a real travelogue program. We go all the way around the world.
The ascent of maths.
And I think the journey of the program sort of mirrors the intellectual journey. So I think people will enjoy it for all the interesting places we've been to. We went to a temple in Gwalior, just south of Delhi, where the first zero has ever been recorded or carved into this temple wall. We went to the Great Wall of China to understand the maths that was used to build the wall. So it's been a really fascinating journey for me. Mathematics is taught so ahistorically in university and school that it was a real journey of discovery for me. I found out about things of my subject I never knew before.
Did you try and work out who the first mathematicians were? Where did they come from?
Well, it's very interesting. It focuses ancient Egypt and ancient Babylon are really the beginning of maths beginning to bubble up. And I think it's really something to do with the rivers that go through there, the Nile and the Euphrates. They produce very vibrant economies, and then people wanted to start to measure the land to be able to tax it. Unfortunately, taxes comes back to taxes and death, of course. They needed to manage the land, and that led to looking at geometry and numbers. So I think it's very hard to, you know, name people, although there are Egyptian scribes whose names we do know and that have survived bits of papyrus with mathematics on. But it's interesting that it really started around these two rivers.
Well, we'll look forward to that. Bobby, you've got a question.
I'm feeling really positive about maths now, in a way I probably haven't since I was about 18.
Well done,
when
Marcus.
I decided
well,
to
I've
ditch,
succeeded then.
When I decided to ditch maths and become an arty farty tosser.
Look at what happens
at university.
Technology.
But now I'm thinking, okay, if I want to go back and kind of pick up where I left off and get my head around some of this stuff, which is
and become a spy.
I'm already a spy, James. Now going to be executed. Where do I start? What can you suggest some good places that we could start?
I mean, my books are aimed at those people who kind of were intrigued what it was about but never got it. So, and there are a lot of great maths books, popular maths books being written. So I think that's the place to start. But then you need to start learning a more technical side of the language. And I think it's a little bit like learning a musical instrument. First of all, you hear all these wonderful pieces of guitar music and you want to play the guitar like that. But actually, to be able to repeat that process requires quite a lot of hard grafting, and that you have to learn the technical side of the language of mathematics, and that does require going down to these bookshops and finding all those yellow books that I talked about earlier on that have all the technical side in it. But I think that's what we're missing at school, is that we just show them the technical side at school and don't excite them about all the wonderful mathematical music that's out there that they'll be able to play if they learn that. So I think that we need to combine both the hard graft of maths with the sort of very beautiful side that you can show them.
Marcus, I've just got one question to finish this excellently inspiring session with. Are you really good at Sudoku?
I had my appendix out a couple of years ago and I was in hospital and I decided to crack the Sudoku and see whether I could come up with an algorithmic method to be able to basically sort out any Sudoku. And after that, it became totally boring. And I'm sure people who do Sudoku, I don't think there'll be Sudokus in the newspapers in about 5 years' time, because either you can do them and they start to get boring, or else you can't do them and they're boring. And so I think that's the next step. You do a Sudoku, you need something a bit more challenging. So just try the Riemann hypothesis about primes. That's your next step. It's the ultimate Sudoku.
I think we should just definitely have those on the puzzle pages. Marcus, thank you so much. Sadly, or perhaps happily, it'd be wrong for us to assume, of course, that's us done for another week. My thanks to everyone in the pod, James Randerson, Ian Sample, Bobby Johnson, Nell Bowes, and of course, our special guest, Marcus de Sotoy. To comment on anything you've heard in this week's show, head to blogs.guardian.co.uk/science or leave a comment on the Facebook wall. Remember, you can also check out the rest of The Guardian's audio output at guardian.co.uk/podcasts. Science Weekly has been produced by Ben Green. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
Guardian Unlimited.